Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
I think that the overturning of Roe versus Wade was disastrous in a material sense for American women, and we're going to fight hard to make sure our rights are restored.
I'm really excited to see this step forward in protecting women. It's not done yet. There's a lot more to do, but this is a great marker of saying that actually as a society, we can do a lot better.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, hello and welcome to another edition of the show with me, Justin Brierley, in what has been a week of political turmoil here in the UK, with the standing down at last of Boris Johnson following many resignations from cabinet members. I'll give you some of my thoughts towards the end of today's show on that. But another big political issue, this time from the US, coming up on today's show. We're going to be talking about abortion, Roe versus Wade being overturned. We'll meet the guests in just a moment's time. Just a reminder, you can find everything you need from Unbelievable at our website, premierunbelievable.com, and you'll get a free ebook and tons of bonus content when you register for our newsletter there. The link is with today's show if you're listening via podcast. And don't forget our very special event coming up now, just a few days away, Tuesday the 12th of July, Michaela Peterson and John McRae for the Big Conversation Live, talking about whether Gen Z and millennials are ready to believe in God. Michaela Peterson is daughter of renowned psychologist Jordan Peterson, has established her own significant YouTube and podcast following, and recently revealed she had found God through a series of spiritual experiences. She'll be talking to John McRae, who runs the popular YouTube channel Why Do You Meme, about the search for meaning and spirituality among the digitally connected next generation. If you want to be part of it, you can be part of the audience live this Tuesday, the 12th of July, 8 p.m. UK. That's 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 noon Pacific. You just need to register at unbelievable.live. It's free to attend. You can join us from anywhere in the world, but you do need to register at unbelievable.live. Looking forward to meeting lots of unbelievable listeners this Tuesday for the Big Conversation Live. Right now, let's get into today's show. Well, today we're talking about the overturning of Roe versus Wade and asking, is it a victory for life or a step back for women's rights? Roe versus Wade was a landmark Supreme Court decision in 1973 that granted access to abortion across the whole of the US. Well, ever since, pro-life groups have lobbied to have it overturned, and last month it happened as the US Supreme Court returned the power to individual states to decide their abortion policy. Well, the decision sparked both celebration and protest in equal measure. So was it a victory for the sanctity of life or a step back for women's rights? Lois McClatchy is a pro-life activist who works for ADF UK, a faith-based legal advocacy organisation, who have argued that Roe versus Wade was a bad law that needed repealing. KS is my other guest, a pro-choice feminist who says that the overturning of Roe versus Wade is a retrograde step for women. So Lois and KS, welcome to the show today. Lois, perhaps we could start with you, and before you sort of give, you know, your views on this particular decision, perhaps you'd like to start by sketching out what Roe versus Wade is, you know, just a little bit of the background to what led up to that particular Supreme Court decision in the first place almost 50 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Justin. So both lives are infinitely important in a pregnancy, but 50 years ago, seven men sitting on a panel decided for the entire nation of America that it would become legal to have an abortion through all 9 months of pregnancy for any reason. Which put America into a very radical position in the world. It was one of only six countries to allow such an extreme abortion regime for any reason up to birth. And on that list of six countries was North Korea and China. So not the best track record of upholding human rights on that list. So it was a radical shift in the way that we dissolved protections for unborn children, for women. But fortunately, what happened recently was that that decision was reversed.
Yeah. KS, do you want to sort of give a bit of your sort of thoughts on where the abortion sort of situation was, you know, perhaps even at the time, you know, that Roe versus Wade came in? To what extent was that a contested law from the outset? And obviously then, yeah, happy to hear your thoughts on what it means now that it's been repealed.
Sure. So Roe versus Wade was the kind of the culmination of a lot of feminist activism at that time. A lot of the second wave feminists from the 1970s were very passionate about a woman's right to choose an abortion. And I think it had obviously very good consequences. You know, I'm a feminist, so I think that it had really incredible consequences. I would quibble with the statement that it legalized abortion all 9 months, because I think it legalized abortion until viability, but then permitted states to apply regulations after that point. So it wasn't a complete victory for, I guess, women's bodily autonomy rights in the way many feminists hoped it would be. That being said, I think it did, allow for many women to choose to end their pregnancies and pursue the lives that they wanted because of that. And I think its overturning is, you know, definitely devastating for many reasons.
Do you want to spell out some of the reasons why you feel it was obviously a retrograde step, KS?
Sure. So we know from just research on the subject that places that restrict abortion often have much worse outcomes for both women and children, right? So we can look at the effects of pro-life policies in places like Texas in the past, in places like Poland today. And we see that what happens is that women often die. Women's lives and opportunities are often restricted because of that. Women have a harder time leaving abusive relationships. We see the outcomes for children are often worse because women have children often when they're not ready. In the United States in particular, pro-life policies are often associated with states that have very poor maternal and health outcomes and outcomes for children. They don't have great social services. And so all those things are really concerning. And I think, you know, aside from all those material effects, there's just a real shock and fear among women that, like, something that seems so fundamental is kind of being jerked away so fast. And, you know, I think we're going to see an enormous feminist pushback as a result of this.
Well, let's turn to you, Lois. Why did you welcome this decision? Why specifically do you think this is a step forward, not only for, I suppose, life, but for women as well?
Well, as someone who is pro-woman, I believe that women deserve much better than abortion. I was a little bit sad to hear you identified as a feminist, chaos, but then you noticed that you identified that women were able to have careers after Roe. And I would like us to see a society where women can have children and careers at that night, but they don't have to pick between one or the other, but that both lives can flourish. You mentioned maternal mortality as well. Let me just respond to that. I know that Poland and Malta are two of the countries in Europe that have some of the greatest protections for unborn life. And they actually have the lowest rates of maternal mortality in the world. So what we can learn from that is that having protections for unborn life can be very good for women and for children. And it's up to having great healthcare systems to support women and children that we see differences there. So I'm really excited to see this step forward in protecting women. It's not done yet. There's a lot more to do to support every woman and child. But this is a great marker of saying that actually as a society, we can do a lot better. Because we know that abortion is actually often not seen or is not the best outcome for women, even if you are a supportive of abortion or not. Most people would agree that women don't necessarily come into their 20s saying that they would like one. Mental health outcomes are actually much poorer for women after abortion. There's a causal link has been identified through academic research between abortion and suicide, which is a tragedy, which is something that we can do far better on. I'm excited to see how we can do better with this start over in the US and seeing how we can do better here in Europe and the UK as well.
Would you like to respond to any of those sort of responses? Yeah, Kaz.
Yeah, so when I say that losing abortion rights is a step back for women and that, you know, women's life outcomes are affected, I certainly am not saying that women who have children can't have careers or women who have children can't go to college or anything like that. But we just know that having children at an inopportune time makes those things harder, and some women won't be able to pursue those goals. And so, I think it's easy to say, well, you know, it's possible to that women can pursue both things. But the fact is that we know that it does make it a lot harder. And sometimes some women won't be able to do it. And sometimes, women will really struggle as a result. So I think regarding, you know, empirical studies, I can provide plenty that would contradict, I think, some of the statements Lois is making about, mental health outcomes, particularly of forced pregnancy versus abortion. And so, I don't know how fruitful it would be to kind of just go back and forth about like different studies, but I think that it would be, there are certainly plenty that show, you know, the opposite, which is that women who get abortions are often much happier and able to leave abusive relationships, pursue what they wish, versus women who are forced to carry pregnancies that they don't want.
I mean, we'll come to the ethical issues, and I will, you know, we'll get into this, you know, a lot more as we go, and I'll give you a chance to respond, Lois. But I mean, just sticking with the ramifications of this change itself, where I mean, a lot of people have responded, Lois, as though, you know, abortion has been outlawed altogether in the US. Now, that's obviously not quite what's happened here. Can you just explain what this actually means in practice in terms of it no longer being, as it were, mandated at a, you know, the overall level in the US?
Yes, exactly. So the court has decided that was the wrong way to make a decision. Like I said at the start, it was seven men who brought around Roe v. Wade, which made it possible, as Cass pointed out, possible for every state to legalize abortion all the way up to birth. And some did. And there was many lives lost across the state. Now that decision will go back to the people. It will go back to democracy. Every state will be able to decide through elected representatives, as it should always have been, how they want to best care for women and children. So this is a pivotal moment. You are right, Justin. It has been a little bit misunderstood here in Europe, that it seems to be that abortion has completely been eradicated. It hasn't. But it has come back to more of a European standard. So in Europe, the average protection for life in European countries falls around about after 12 weeks, which is much better protection than we've seen in most states pre-Roe. So actually, states are given the option to come towards a more European model, which is seen as a little bit more humane, to be able to protect lives.
And what are you seeing yourself, KS, now on the ground, as it were? What will this look like in states? Presumably there are some states which will still have very liberal abortion laws and so on. But presumably there will be other states who, you know, roll back to a more conservative perspective. What can you give us a few examples of what will happen in practice now?
Sure. So we're going to see, like Lois said, we're going to see a whole patchwork of different legal restrictions on abortion. So, you know, I live in Washington State, which has very strong protections. Basically, they've codified Roe into law here. So I'm personally not going to be affected by abortion restrictions. But other states are going to restrict it possibly completely. There are different laws in different states that restrict it, some to 12 weeks, some to 6 weeks, some to 18. And I think you're just going to see like a lot of churn and women like fleeing pro-life states to go to pro-choice states to get an abortion. Probably the rise of a lot of illegal abortions in states like Texas, which we hope are not as deadly as they were in the past with the rise of abortion pills. So I, you know, it is a very worrisome thing. And I think I'm not a legal expert by any means, but I think this is going to get very, very messy. And I'm a little worried about the future there for sure.
Well, I'll come back to you, Lois, in a moment for a response on that issue of whether restricting abortion is then more dangerous because of, you know, backstreet abortion and unregulated practices and so on. But why do you think this was overturned then, KS? If this is such a bad news for women, why did the judges take that view? Why, you know, and obviously there are a good number in the US who are celebrating with Lois on this.
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, I'm not, like I said, I'm not a legal expert. It's hard to avoid the conclusion that the conservative turn in the court has caused this. You know, the Supreme Court has made a number of very traditionally conservative rulings recently. The latest was about the EPA kind of restricting some really helpful policies regarding that. And so, you know, as to the why, I think it probably has a lot to do with this rightward shift in the courts. That with all that being said, I actually agree with Lois in some regards, in that I don't think Roe versus Wade was ever the really strong protection of abortion rights that women wanted. I really feel like both sides were a little unsatisfied with how it turned out. I mean, you know, if you think about abortion rights, the first thing that comes to mind, whether you're pro-life or pro-choice, is not really privacy, right? That seems like kind of a strange thing to build the case around. And that's kind of what feminists noted even in the 1970s. Catherine MacKinnon has a great piece on that. I mean, a lot of mixed feelings about this and, you know, a lot of fear, but a lot of hope that we're moving in a better direction.
From your perspective, where does this leave the states, Lois? KS, you know, refers to it as a patchwork now, and ultimately, in some states, it will make it more dangerous for women, she says, because in more conservative, you know, where there are tighter restrictions, women might go and do, you know, go to unregulated backstreet abortions and so on. Is that a concern of yours? Do you see a rise in you know, dangerous types of abortion taking place when it's restricted?
No, in developed countries, as the US is, there is very limited or very little rise in death from abortion after abortion is restricted. As I said earlier about Malta and Poland having the lowest maternal death rates in the world and having some of the best protections for life, we actually see it comes down to healthcare provision and what and how society and yeah, over to the states as well, how they can provide better to support women and support unborn children. So there is work to be done to make sure that every life is protected, but we won't. There's limited reason to believe that there would be more death and dangerous abortion because of that in a developed country like the US. And that's actually true across other parts of the world as well. We can see studies from Rwanda, from Ethiopia, and Chile and other countries where abortion has become more restricted when lives have been more protected from earlier stages. We haven't necessarily seen a rise in deaths. So there isn't a causal link there. When it comes over to the court and the direction there, yeah, KS represents a lot of pro-choice people and pro-life people who agree that Roe v. Wade was a bad law. So I think, yeah, I pulled a quote earlier from Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who was well known to be a very pro-abortion justice. And she even herself said that Roe was a heavy-handed judicial intervention which prolongs divisiveness and deferred stable settlement of the issue on abortion. So this definitely is a very contentious law. So both sides, I think, were quite right to see, you know, be pleased with it being overturned.
I just want to say I'm not happy about Roe being overturned, but I agree with Lois that it was never as strong or as strong as we would have liked a defense of abortion rights. And so, you know, going forward, I suspect we're going to see much more grassroots feminist movements in these states that are really restricting abortion. I think we're already starting to see that. And I'm hoping that this tide will start to turn and we'll see much better laws that are stronger and more secure being put into place.
There have been claims, you know, I've seen it surface on social media and elsewhere, that in some places, this will mean that women can now be prosecuted for simply having a miscarriage. You know, that there are laws that would, I mean, I don't know where that comes from, what kind of interpretation of a law that would look like. Lois, do you know where those sorts of claims originate from?
They're not true. Pro-lifers don't campaign for laws that would prosecute a miscarriage. Pro-lifers don't see miscarriage as abortion. So that is fundamentally untrue. And there would be support and protection for women who face those terrible situations.
Oh, I'll jump in there because I disagree, mainly because we've already seen examples of women getting prosecuted for miscarriage. A great example is Brittany Pula, who was convicted of manslaughter because prosecutors believed she had caused her miscarriage, which most people outside of the court case disagreed with. So she faces, I think, 4 years in prison for that.
I do think a lot of the stories that hit the media in support of that often don't cover a lot of the detail involved, while examples are good, they're important to really look behind some of the headlines on. But I would say that abortion laws or abortion restrictions don't even prosecute a woman if the abortion is done to save her life. So far less would they prosecute miscarriage. But in instances, for example, if a miscarriage was to be prosecuted, it would only ever be related to if another crime has been committed to cause the miscarriage. For example, if a drug offense has been committed and therefore a miscarriage has happened because of that kind of crime, and then it would be a part two. Or related, but it would never be an independent crime so far as I'm aware.
Well, but I think we should clarify that miscarriages will at times be prosecuted, right? Because if it is in conjunction with those situations, they will be. And regarding prosecuting women for getting abortions, I think actually a lot of pro-life activists have a very naive view of the law, where they're like, if the law says that women won't get prosecuted, it will never happen. But that's not really how things work in the real world. As an example, we just saw a couple weeks ago, Lizelle Herrera was prosecuted for inducing an abortion under the Texas law. And the charges were dropped, but only after she'd spent several days in jail, been extremely traumatized, and so on. And so these laws are going to cause a lot of turmoil among women who are suspected of causing an abortion, who maybe had a miscarriage, but people aren't sure. It's going to cause stress and trauma. And I think we should not pretend otherwise there. We've already seen that happening.
Even in those instances, going back to whether, going behind the headlines, etc., any such instances would be extremely, extremely rare. We have to legislate on the majority circumstances. So I think the fundamental issue here is about the right to life and the right to, for a baby to, and protecting women as well from the trauma of abortion. So I think that's a very, very narrow circumstance that if it should ever arise.
Well, that's true, but we've also only seen Roe versus Wade overturned for a couple days now. So it's hard to kind of say, oh, it's not going to be a big deal, it's not going to be a problem, when we have already seen cases of it happening. And we have every reason to believe that these cases are going to increase, particularly because I think states are really going to have a hard time enforcing these laws. Like I said, abortion pills are fairly accessible via mail in a lot of places. And I am really worried about how states are going to deal with the fact that women are probably going to turn to illegal abortions going out of state, etc., for these matters.
Do you think that... ultimately, it should be the abortion providers, if they are breaking the law in a particular state, that should be prosecuted? Or do you think there is a time and a place when a woman herself may be prosecuted for seeking an abortion that perhaps falls outside of the rules of a particular state?
Well, let me go back first to what KS was addressing first. And then I think that we should be making sure that the law enforcement meets the standard required for human rights to be upheld, for society to function. And the answer to bad law enforcement is not change the law to make it worse, but to make sure that law enforcement comes to meet the standard of the law. So I think instead of circulating bad instances, we should aim higher. We should aim for a state where where that would be the case. And yeah, I mean, let's like look at where this this goes. But it would certainly seem plausible that abortion providers would be culpable in such circumstances. But let's wait and see how things shake out.
So I would address that too, because that argument always seemed, I actually just wrote something about this. The idea of prosecuting abortion providers but not women in an abortion is a very bizarre position to take, I think. It's a bit like saying, you know, if you hire a hitman to kill someone, from the pro-life perspective, you aren't culpable, but the hitman should face all the charges. Or if you buy a gun from someone and use that gun to kill someone, that would be like saying that, you know, you aren't to be charged, but the person who sold you the gun should be charged. So immediately there's very weird ethical implications to this approach that don't really make sense to me, and I think don't make sense to a lot of people, which is one of the reasons that I think that these laws, even if they seem right now to be, leaving women in the free and clear, I kind of suspect these laws will eventually start coming down on women who get abortions, because it just doesn't really make sense.
I think probably a reason to not prosecute women, and I think I would fall in this, and it is a really interesting discussion. The reason to not prosecute women, which is my current position, would be because they are often actually unaware of the true, all the facts about abortion. They're often not given, the media is often not being honest about what an abortion is and what it entails. Often we haven't heard the true story of what a human being is like at 6 weeks, at 12 weeks, at 15 weeks gestation. And they're often also under a lot of pressure. I know in my country, the UK, that a recent BBC survey found that between 1 in 10 and 1 in 5 women turn out to an abortion clinic feeling that they've been pressured into the decision, whether that's by a partner, parents, friends, maybe it's even by socioeconomic circumstances, but they say that they felt pressured and coerced. So there is a lot of reason and discussion in there about why a woman would not be prosecuted, but it's, obviously a much, much wider discussion.
And I've heard those arguments as well, but my final thought on that is just, to me, those would be more like extenuating circumstances that you would, use to give someone a lesser sentence, for example. They're not really reason to charge the provider and not charge the pregnant woman, particularly because if you are going by the standard that the women don't really understand it's a human life, well, certainly abortion providers would seem to be vulnerable to that same misinformation, although I would not call that misinformation. But, the same logic should apply to them and not just the women if you think it's a case of not understanding the true value of human life or something along those lines.
Like at least one of the circumstances that I mentioned is definitely usually the norm, in that it's often due to circumstances of pressure, and that I think there is a general lack of awareness in our society right now about everything that abortion entails for women. So I'd say that those are still probably quite solid.
Let's move, because naturally the conversation is moving from the law itself to the ethical dimension of this, and we're going to do that in the next part of the show. And I know that, in particular, the issue of personhood is an important one for UKS in terms of deciding where the rights lie and, the priorities how we should weigh those up. And of course, one of the main slogans that has been, around, and when people have been protesting this recent change, has been "My body, my choice." I just want to talk about some of those issues with you both, if that's okay, in the next section. And so we'll turn to those ethical issues. We're talking about a big issue, a hot button issue. It's very topical in the US at the moment, the overturning of Roe versus Wade. And my guests today are Lois McClatchy and KS. I'll make sure there are links to both of their websites where you can find out more about them with today's show. But we'll be back in just a moment's time.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to today's show. We're talking about abortion today, particularly the overturning of Roe versus Wade. A landmark decision from 1973 has been met by another landmark decision just last month, and obviously it's been met with celebration by pro-lifers, a huge amount of protest and consternation from the pro-choice side of this. And both of those perspectives represented today, Lois McClatchy, pro-life activist with ADF UK, and KS, a pro-choice feminist. So I wanted to turn to the ethical kind of side of this, because ultimately this to some extent determines what your view of what the law should be is anyway. As I say, one of the most common sort of slogans you see around this is my body, my choice. That sort of issue of the bodily autonomy you've already sort of said about that is so important, KS, for women. Just explain what you understand by that slogan, KS, my body, my choice. Is it basically that if a woman has a total say over what happens to her body and within her body, and that should be protected by law, essentially?
Not quite. I would say, you know, obviously my body, my choice doesn't mean that, you know, someone has the right to do whatever they want with their body. That would violate a lot of laws. But it is a sort of shorthand expression to describe the importance of bodily autonomy to women. So that's the right to, like, use your bodily resources in the way you wish, right? And the fact that you're not obligated to give up those resources, even to save the life of another person or another fetus, depending on your personal view of that. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great slogan. I definitely think it is very focused on the bodily autonomy argument, not so much the personhood side of things, which is the one that I'm more interested in. But I think it's, you know, I'm a believer that bodily autonomy arguments are actually quite successful. And so I have no real problem with it. I just think, like all slogans, you know, it's not enough to repeat a slogan. You actually have to have some theory behind it and, you know, arguments. And so that's part of what I've been really interested in developing.
Yeah, here's a hypothetical. Okay, say in a scenario where perhaps, you know, there's myself and one other person, and they've lost a great deal of blood in an accident, and I could, if I just gave them a pint of blood, save their life, but I cannot be charged or, you know, be criminalized for simply choosing not to do that. Is that the kind of bodily autonomy you're talking about? That if I choose not to do something that saves another person's life, that kind of interferes with my bodily autonomy, that I cannot be held culpable for their death or anything like that?
Yeah, I think that's pretty much what a lot of pro-choice or a lot of autonomy argument / like the slogan is getting at. You know, it does seem like people often say, you know, if you found out someone needed a kidney transplant and you were the only one available to give that kidney transplant, you wouldn't be obligated to do so. And so that suggests that sort of the right to life doesn't sort of beat out, if you will, the right to bodily autonomy. Even if that person will die without that transplant, you still aren't obligated to give that to them. And so, of course, that's very important for women, right? Because women throughout history have often had their bodily autonomy rights completely disregarded. You know, they've often been treated as little better than slaves historically. So, you know, this is a very sensitive and personal issue for many women.
Yeah. Okay, Lois, what do you make of that bodily autonomy argument then?
Sure. Well, I support my body, my choice in terms of I support everybody. And obviously the baby inside a woman is a distinct living and whole human being. I support their rights to their body as well. I think KS brought up the idea of a kidney transplant, and it's right. In that situation, you aren't obligated to give your kidney to stop someone else from dying. But in that case, you would be stopping them from an inevitable death. But in terms of a pregnancy, that's a little bit different because you would be intentionally making a move to end their life, which I believe is a slightly different circumstance. If we kind of bring this kind of scenario and into something like outside the womb, that we can imagine a little better, because sometimes it's quite hard to conceptualize a baby in the womb. But if we think about, for example, conjoined twins, they are two individuals who are depend on each other for life, but we recognize and we ensure as a society that it would be wrong to end the life of one. So I think in this circumstance, the right to life is important to be upheld, and we find solutions to best protect both lives in that scenario.
So I'll respond to that. First, I think you were kind of hitting on that distinction between killing and letting die. And I think that's an important distinction to think about. But if you apply it to abortion, it's a little bit strange because there are certainly types of abortions that do not involve direct killing. I think there's one called, I'm probably going to say this wrong, hysterotomy, right, where you just remove the uterus. That would be more of a situation of letting die, right, because you're not directly killing the fetus, but you're simply removing it from the body, and it simply can't survive outside the woman's body. Another might be medication abortion, right, which simply makes the woman's body inhospitable for the developing embryo. And so neither of those, strictly speaking, involve killing. They involve either removing or changing the features of the body to make make life inhospitable, I suppose, for the embryo / fetus. You know, you can make that distinction, but I think it only really gets you so far from a pro-life perspective. And there are further arguments you can develop that say, you know, if you think those kinds of abortions are acceptable, then it's a bit odd to simply say that other forms that are much less damaging are unacceptable. Like, you know, you're just basically saying you can only bring about the death of the fetus in a certain way, which is a little strange, although some people might accept it. Go ahead.
Sure. No, I'll just push back on that a little. An abortion would remove a child from its natural habitat, and it would deprive it of oxygen, and it would deprive it of the things that it's been living on. And I think that is still killing. It's still distinct from just choosing not to save. I think that we do have to have a clear distinction there. I think legally speaking, coming at this from a kind of like human rights law perspective, which is my background actually, often this is kind of weighed up as the fundamental right to life versus bodily autonomy. And that's an interesting concept. So the right to life in international law is cherished in some of the most important international legal documents, the ICCPR, which is kind of one of the very cornerstones of human rights. And it's quite a unique, it's one of few human rights which are not qualified. So other rights have extenuating circumstances where they can be limited a little. For example, in the time of a national crisis, human rights law allows the government to suspend some rights, but they do not allow the government to suspend the right to life. So that seems very fundamental. On the other hand, bodily autonomy is obviously something that's very, very important. And I don't deny that it's very important. It's bodily autonomy for sure. But at the same time, we've seen in times of national crisis that the government are allowed to a certain extent to limit bodily autonomy for the good of a nation, for a greater good in a time of national emergency. So we can see from a legal perspective that the right to life does become a little bit more significant and important in that balance. So we should find ways to support both the woman and the baby in the pregnancy.
Yeah, so I'll respond to that really quick because, you know, I think there's a problem with sort of comparing pregnancy with other sorts of things, like, say, getting a vaccine that involve much less degree of harm/transformation/ you know, massive effects on a woman's life and well-being and future. And so I often hear people say, like, oh, well, if, you know, you make vaccines mandatory, that's like a violation of autonomy. And so that means that autonomy generally can be disregarded with regard to abortion. And I would push back on that simply because I think the degree of sort of insult or harm or problems that pregnancy brings about is actually very relevant and should not be sort of disregarded in favor of, like, this, if you a little bit can be sacrificed, then it all can be. I would compare pregnancy more to organ donation, right? They actually have very similar fatality rates, donating a kidney. And I think very few people would find the idea of forced kidney donations, forced organ donations, as a way to alleviate some kind of ill. Very few people would find that to be an acceptable cost, I guess, for any good.
Mm-hmm. Pregnancy and vaccines are undeniably different, for sure. I absolutely agree. They are different things. But I would say pregnancy is even more significant in this scenario because it involves another human life. directly, and that human life would be very compromised in that issue. So I would say the heightened stakes are even more significant for the argument that that both lives should be protected.
And if I could jump in here, Chaos, obviously the big distinction for Lois between a kidney and an unborn baby is that there's a very different moral difference between removing, you know, essentially an organ or a vestigial organ or whatever to the baby. And this is obviously where we come to the second issue, which is, well, what are we talking about here? Because that is obviously going to make a huge difference. So it's the personhood of... So Lois said, well, it's not one body you're talking about, it's two bodies. There's the body of another child. You're not just removing a sort of a clump of cells or, you know, whatever, a fetus. It's a baby, it's a person, it's a human. And that body has rights if you're talking about bodily autonomy. So why for you is that not the same as the kind of...
Well, I would be careful there, because we're not comparing a kidney to a fetus, first of all. When I use that example, I'm assuming that there's a person who will die without a kidney transplant, right? So that would be the thing that's comparable to the fetus. So the reason that women, pro-choice women, often go directly to bodily autonomy arguments is that they kind of often want to just bypass the personhood debate and immediately start talking about, well, even if it was a person, we would not think this was justified. So I just wanted to kind of clarify what was actually being compared there.
Well, thank you for the clarification, but I suppose it does still lead to the question of the, you know, the moral status of the unborn child. So what's even the language, I think, is interesting, because you've obviously chosen to talk about a fetus, an embryo. Would you not use the word baby for a child that hasn't come to term during pregnancy?
I mean, you could use the term. I don't think it really has an impact on kind of the ethics or of the discussion what term you use. But I have noticed that pro-life people often insist on using specific terms to kind of create like an emotional effect, and suggest that women who use like just the scientifically accurate terms are being heartless and so on. And so I try to avoid using sort of loaded language like that. Although, you know, if you talk to people in the street, I have no problem using those terms, but oftentimes using those terms suggests an agreement with the pro-life position that the fetus is similar or comparable in moral status to the baby or the embryo, or the zygote or the embryo is also comparable to a child or a person. And that's something I would challenge for sure.
What's your feeling on the language before we get to the sort of the philosophical issue of the person?
Oh, sure. I mean, so whale, when whales are pregnant, they have whale fetuses. When sheep are pregnant, they have sheep fetuses. When humans are pregnant, they have human fetuses, which is the correct terminology scientifically. But when do you look at that? Have you ever seen a 3D ultrasound? It's amazing. You can see what's in there, and it's a baby. I've held babies in my arms, and you know, a few weeks before they were in the womb, and they look the same in there as they were outside. So I don't think it's location or geography that changes that term. Perhaps one's more colloquial, one's more scientific, but I think they are the same thing, and I'm very comfortable using the term baby to describe a human baby in a human womb.
I mean, coming back to you then, KS, on this issue, regardless of the language we may choose to use or not, what for you makes the key distinction between the personhood of the mother and the personhood of the child or fetus or whatever in the womb?
Well, I think first to understand that, we should understand the pro-life perspective, which is essentially that personhood is simply determined by being an organism of type Homo sapiens. And usually they kind of treat this as if it's simply a scientific question and not an ethical question. And I think that that's simply incorrect. So to clarify that, I would say there are certainly human organisms that I think are uncontroversially not persons, or that we would agree do not have a right to life. So the most common example people bring up is at the end of life, right? When you have someone who is, let's say, permanently comatose, and you're like, well, you know, there comes a time where we might, you know, choose either euthanasia, or, you know, we might switch off the life support and allow that person to pass. We don't consider that murder, because we no longer consider that human organism to be a person, really, right? It's no longer something that has a right to life. It no longer has a right to, to those to that bodily support. And so we can use that sort of example to think about when right to life might apply to the fetus. And in short, I would argue that a right to life starts to apply when that fetus begins to have some sort of psychological experience. And that by that I usually mean, people usually say when that fetus acquires consciousness of some kind, when there's something it's like to be the fetus as opposed to, you know, just some other, like, you know, human cells, right? And so it then becomes kind of a scientific matter of determining when that consciousness arises. And that's, I think, when we should really consider personhood to begin. And I think this view has some other advantages, too, in that it allows for kind of a broader acceptance of animals as persons, right? So the pro-life view tends to restrict personhood to human organisms. It suggests that personhood is simply identical to being a human organism. And I think as people have become more influenced by the environmentalist movement and, you know, works by Peter Singer and so on, they've come to believe that animals, too, have psychological experiences and they, you know, should not suffer unnecessarily and so on. And so they've come to have kind of a broader view of personhood in that way.
Hmm. Lois, feel free to respond.
Let me start by saying that the premise of human rights depends on human equality. And we know from historic examples, we know from human experience that equality cannot come from any sort of merit that we earn. It can't come from our gender. It can't come from the color of our skin. It can't come from anything else. And when you boil it down to what is the fundamental thing that makes all humans equal, it's that we are fundamentally all part of the human family. Now, let me pick up on the first point that KS raised about euthanasia, which is incredibly controversial, especially given that in most of Europe it is not legal. It is considered very much a crime to end a person's life like that. We use the term kind of human organism, you know, to describe this human being who is not considered a person anymore. But I think if you ask a doctor in the hospital what the families are saying, why they're ending that person's life, they very rarely say, oh, well, this human organism is no longer a person. That's not how we view and treat human beings. And even if you are someone who thinks that the euthanasia is the right and ethical decision at that point, I'd be very concerned and surprised if you think that it's okay to do anything you want to that human body. If you think it's all right to draw on their face, if you think it's all right to disrespect their body, to use them for abuse, for anything like that. So clearly they hold a distinct moral value over and above what other creatures hold. I was interested about the point on animals to consider that they are persons, but to me, it's very clear from a human rights law perspective, at least, that they do not hold the gambit of basic rights that we instinctively know as humans. The right to life, maybe that's debatable for vegans, et cetera, except that it's, maybe some people believe that they have a fundamental right to life, but there's certainly, you know, the right to healthcare, the right to education, all of these things we don't attribute to animals. So I think intuitively, we don't consider them persons. So when it comes to where we are drawing what makes a person, it has to be the thing that we share most of all fundamentally. And at the end of the day, the only way to ensure true equality and to uphold this basis on which we built our society, on which we have built a human rights law and established the equality of all people, is that we are simply human.
So I'll respond to, there's a couple good points in there that I'd like to respond to. So the first is kind of this concern that if we assign personhood or consider personhood to be something that arises from having sort of psychological experiences, that will somehow exclude, you know, oppressed groups or maybe lead to some sort of, you know, terrible genocide of certain minorities or something like that. I've heard that a lot, right? So there's kind of a fear there. And I'll just say that, you know, I think that fear is only valid if you believe that there are some groups of minorities or oppressed people that simply have no inner lives, no experiences, no psychological capabilities, which seems self-evidently false. And I'd also add that, you know, creating a biological basis for personhood is itself very open to abuse. You know, most fascist regimes have, you know, called certain groups subhuman, and they've usually argued that those groups, you know, the groups of people, are biologically inferior, or they simply don't have the exact type of human biology that they think is relevant. And so, I think this idea that we are safe, we can only be safe if we sort of grant personhood to everything of type Homo sapiens or whatever you'd like to call it. The idea that we're safe that way is simply not true. I think the idea that there's risk with my view is also not true, since we all agree, hopefully, that like there are no minority groups that have no inner lives, no personalities, and so on.
Just before Lois responds to that, just to tease that out a bit more, KS, I mean, if the issue is at what point the baby or fetus develops what you describe a kind of psychological sort of ability, value, and that sort of then imbues the baby with certain rights at that point, do you have a rough idea of when that is? Would that be at some point within the pregnancy, or would it be even fall outside of the pregnancy after their birth or something like that?
I think at that point you basically have to look at the scientific research, right, to get some idea. And I would generally say, as a good standard, I think that personhood should begin when some organism has like an initial consciousness of some kind, right, even if it's very basic. And so I've done a lot of research on this myself, and I found that the best place for that is at birth. So that always sounds like a little too pat, I suppose, but it actually makes a lot of sense, because it has to do with basically the uterine environment. So the uterine environment is a kind of a low oxygen environment that has a lot of, as a result, essentially has a lot of hormones that cause basically sedation of the fetus throughout pregnancy. And, I've done a lot of research on kind of animal research, or, reading papers by animal researchers on this subject that I've collected on my blog. And so I think the most reasonable place for, considering the beginning of personhood is when that fetus leaves that body, when it's, exposed to air and kind of shocked into alertness. I think everyone's kind of seen at birth has probably seen that transformation. And so that's where I would personally draw the line. Now, other researchers say, well, I would prefer, right, or other philosophers, I should say, usually look at some kind of neurological milestone. And they usually say, well, around 28 weeks is when the cerebral cortex begins to form. And the cerebral cortex is responsible for sort of the thought and cognition. And so that's when we should consider the fetus to be a person. And so you'll get different answers about that. But I think the important thing to remember is that wherever you draw that line, kind of cognition or psychology, the vast majority of abortions happen well before it. So, I find it usually helpful to get some kind of agreement about those early abortions that form the vast majority of them before discussing those edge cases.
Okay, Lois, go ahead and your response to that.
So, in terms of a kind of a scientific response, but then also a kind of more philosophical side as well. And you've gone into this in a great deal, KS. But my thoughts are that we have evidence that at the end of the first trimester, if you have twins in the womb, they are much more careful when they're flailing their arms around their twins' faces, because they know that that is something that's a more sensitive area than they are in other spaces. We know that they respond to touch, they respond to different voices, to music sometimes. So we do know that there's some level of response to them, and that makes that argument quite difficult about where to really pin that down. But what I would like to do is kind of let's bring this out of the womb, because like I said, sometimes it's easier to envision what it's like for a child who's outside of the womb. Or even for myself, I know that there's I spend a great majority of my 24 hours asleep, or a great time of my 24 hours asleep, and I'm not conscious at that point. So does my personhood kind of go up and down during the day, depending on how conscious I am, and doesn't that cause problems for where we are? But let's say, if I was to take the point and say, okay, even if our value does depend on consciousness, surely that can't be exactly why we are valuable as humans. Not only because that would be kind of depending on my sleeping capability or someone's unconsciousness after an accident and coming back, But it also, that indicates to me that it has to, that argument has to allow some sort of capacity for consciousness. I'm asleep, but I will wake up. I've been in an accident, but maybe I'll recover. But if that is the case, is it okay then, in your opinion, to, for people who are in that state, to be mistreating them? Let's even put it back in them. Let's put this back to the abortion question. If we had kind of a form, this is kind of a horrible thing to imagine, if we had a form of unconscious fetuses from an early age, and we took many of them out of the womb, and they were not conscious, but they were there just in human beings, and we created lots of these, and we used them for experiments, or we used them for abuse, for gratification, for weird and difficult and unethical things. Would that be unethical in your perspective because they aren't conscious? Or is there a moral, we have to have a moral respect for a human being, even if they're not conscious?
Well, so a couple things. One, my argument really isn't just that, like, only conscious beings or only conscious humans have personhood. It's to say that personhood begins with an initial consciousness and ends with, like, that final consciousness. Like, you know, when someone enters like a permanent coma, say, I would say that that's no longer a person. And I think we intuitively see that there's a distinction between, say, you know, going to someone who's temporarily under anesthesia and taking off their life support machine, and going to someone who is, you know, permanently comatose, say, or, and turning off their life support machine. Obviously, the person who is just under anesthesia still has, you know, mental states, desires, even if they're not turning their attention to them at that time. So I just want to kind of highlight that my argument is not that, you know, you have to be conscious to have personhood. That I think is kind of a misstatement. Now, I think you made one other interesting point about corpses, or sorry, about like mistreating, I'm like thinking of something else, mistreating like bodies or and so on. And the suggestion seems to be, and I agree, like it's immoral to mistreat, you know, a body that's permanently comatose. Like you shouldn't like draw on its face or whatever. And I would say that that's also true about like a dead body or a corpse, right? Like we shouldn't mistreat a corpse. You know, it's obviously immoral to do all sorts of icky things there. But that the immorality of that does not come from the fact that that dead body is a person, or that that human organism is a person. The immorality of that comes from, you know, the fact that we might just think it's vicious or grotesque or something else to do those things. And I would argue that that is not analogous to abortion.
But why is it immoral?
We'll come back to you for a response to this, Lois, in just a moment's time. We're going to go to our final break, and then I'll allow you to come straight back on this. We were kind of deep into the kind of ethical and philosophical arguments here on Unbelievable on abortion. We'll be continuing it as we begin to draw our conversation to a close. Lois McClatchy and KS from Defending Feminism are my guests today.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to this week's edition of the show. And before we continue the debate on abortion, Roe versus Wade, just to let you know, some feedback's coming up later on in the programme. We've also got episode 5 of The Big Conversation coming up next week. Robotics, transhumanism and life beyond Earth. Astronomer Royal Lord Martin Rees and bioethicist Dr. John Wyatt will be joining me to discuss whether AI and robotics are a friend or foe of human flourishing. Lord Rees recently published On the Future, Prospects for Humanity, a book on these themes. And John Wyatt has also published The Robot Will See You Now. Really interesting discussion between them coming up on that theme, along with clips of me actually interacting with a robot too on next week's show. So look out for that. On the profile later on tonight, Jendela Benson, the British-Nigerian novelist, opens up to Sam Hales about her money laundering conviction and how the love and support of her church family helped keep her faith alive while her husband was in prison. She's also featured in this month's Premier Christianity magazine. You can get a free copy at their website, premierchristianity.com. But Jendela is on the podcast of The Profile as well if you want to catch it that way. On our other podcast from Premier Unbelievable, you can currently find on Ask N.T. Wright Anything, Tom's teaching on Galatians from a new Bible course there. On Matters of Life and Death, John and Tim Wyatt talking about simulation and deep fakes. That's currently under discussion. On the C.S. Lewis podcast with Alistair McGrath, I'm continuing to walk through some of the shorter works of Lewis with Alistair. Currently, Is Theology Poetry, which includes Lewis's memorable phrase, "I believe in Christianity as I believe the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else." And of course, our newest podcast is Unapologetic. Currently, you can hear Lisa Fields of the Jude 3 Project talking about her work as a black Christian woman in apologetics. So all of that available from our website, premierunbelievable.com. For now, let's get back into today's show. Well, we've been having a really interesting ethical discussion towards the end of today's programme as we've been looking at this Roe versus Wade decision. Lois McClatchy from ADF UK and KS from Defending Feminism are both with me today. If you want the websites, by the way, adf.uk for Lois, defendingfeminism.com for KS. And just in that last segment, KS saying, well, the reason we don't disrespect a corpse is perhaps the same reason we don't disrespect the body of someone who is perhaps in a permanent vegetative state. It's more about sort of what that says about us, I suppose, rather than the corpse or the body of the individual in question, if we were to go about doing that. And it's interesting because there have been, you know, actual cases where, you know, involving either aborted fetuses or miscarriages where there was an outcry when, for instance, it was revealed that a hospital in the UK at one time had been using that as sort of just matter to kind of fuel the furnace in the hospital boiler. And there were a lot of people who were outraged at that because that seems wrong to treat, you know, to treat these dead bodies of babies effectively as fuel. But that's KS's view, I assume, on that, Lois, would be, well, it's not about the bodies, it's about the sort of the fact that we wouldn't treat living people like that, and so it's a reflection of the living person that person might have been or was that's really at stake there. What's your response to that kind of view?
Yeah, I think at the heart of that is, why is it bad? I mean, we can say it's bad because it makes us feel bad about ourselves, it's bad because it's icky, but these are slightly circular. We're kind of saying it's bad because it's bad and we're bad people for doing it, but why is it bad? Why should we have respect for someone who is or in one case was a person? And so I think we have to like really consider this consciousness. You know, if we talked about, Kesh, you mentioned, you know, sleeping people have desires or dreams or intentions, which I suppose is true. But the fetus, although it maybe does not have a desire yet, it certainly has an interest. It has an interest in being born, and abortion would act against its interests. So I think there's something to be considered there. And we want to just really dig into the why would it be wrong to limit somebody who has a capacity for consciousness, which is true of a fetus. They do, even if we are to accept that they are unconscious in the womb, if we were to accept that, they have a capacity to do that, to become conscious. So we are limiting that and taking that chance for life or chance for consciousness away, taking that life away. And that to me is the same as somebody further on in their lives. And we also, you know, not on a more sad note, when we're talking about dreams and desires, some people don't have a dream and desire for life in certain states or of mental illness. Sometimes people feel suicidal and they don't have a desire for life, but it's our instinct and our human intuition to support that person and to help them to live and to support them to regain their purpose and their meaning in life. So we don't base this on desire, we don't base it on dreaming. And I think generally speaking, outside the womb, we do not base it on consciousness. So there must be something deeper there that unites us in saying that we don't mistreat. We give rights and we give respect to persons. And in that category of persons is all human beings, no matter what they're doing, what they're saying, what they're able to contribute.
Yeah, so a lot there. So I'm going to try to do the last one first, and then I'll circle back. But I think you really brought up an interesting idea there with, like, kind of the idea of, like, a suicidal teenager, right? And, you know, obviously that person is like, I don't have any desire to live anymore. And what's the appropriate response to that? Well, you know, I would probably argue that the suicidal teenager is seriously confused about what he wants, right? I would just maybe make a comparison to, you know, a child who gets in a fight with his father and he says, I hate you, Dad. I never want to see you again, right? And the father says, you might be feeling that way right now, but I know that you're simply confused. You know, they might not say you're confused, but they'll have an understanding that that does not reflect their actual or sort of real desires. And I think the same thing could be said about like a suicidal teenager where we're like, you know, you just broke up with your girlfriend, you know, you didn't get into the college you want and things seem really bad right now, but I know that you actually have that deep desire to live. I know that you are simply confused about what you think you want. And so I would actually contrast that because I think you could have a case where someone truly has no desire to live, right? Like maybe there's a Buddhist monk who has reached such a level of enlightenment that you can say that that monk no longer has any desire to live. And in that particular case, as you know, I would argue that, you know, you aren't harming that monk if you kill him. Now, you might say it's still wrong to do so, but I would say that it's no longer a harm if someone has reached a state where they truly have no more desires like that. And so, I would probably say that, you know, our intuitions can be a little bit tricky there. But I think a lot of these things can be sort of resolved if we think more deeply about the situations in which they arise.
Lois?
Yeah, I think like we have to take obviously the problem of suicide and mental illness very seriously. And you've addressed kind of like one instance of that, you know, with a teenager who's just broken up with a girlfriend. But we also have to take into account the entirety and the seriousness of mental illness and their right and good desires to support those to live instead of die in that state. I think that if we to kind of, I guess, kind of run through this consciousness argument, if a child is unconscious, I think the question is, can they still be wronged? Is probably the fundamental question that we're doing. If someone's not aware of being wronged, is it still okay to wrong them? Again, let's take this outside the womb. So if UKS were, or if I were to go in and to steal your inheritance, and you never knew about it, you never knew that you had missed out on a great pile of money, and I had it and I was enjoying it, but you didn't know. So is what I was doing still wrong if you didn't know about it? And according to our law, according to our general social moral conviction, the answer is yes, I shouldn't have stolen your inheritance. That should be rightfully yours to enjoy. And I've taken it away. I've done one thing. And so we know that people can be wronged, even if they're not conscious of it at the time. And that puts quite a moral difficulty, a very strenuous moral difficulty on harming a child, let alone ending their life in the womb. So what we want to do is instead of harming them, even if they aren't conscious of it, protect that life, see how we can best support it, and see how we can support the woman carrying that child to be able to flourish in her life as well.
Yeah, so I guess I'll say again, you know, my argument doesn't really rely on this sort of idea that you have to be conscious in order to be a person. You know, I'm not saying that, you know, people who are unconscious suddenly like lose that, because I think it's pretty clear that they still have psychological continuity. You know, when you wake up, you're not like a completely new person who has no memory of your past life. You're still connected to your past self. And so your desires and stuff are still there in some sense when you're asleep. And so I don't think that, that like suddenly it's okay to like harm unconscious children or even like, you know, you could probably say that even when you're just kind of staring off into space, you're not really thinking about any particular desire, but you still have them, right? You don't stop like loving your children. And so, you know,
isn't the example that the Lois you're trying to reach here that the act of aborting a baby that is, you know, let's argue preconscious, kind of like stealing the inheritance without them knowing, it's robbing that child of the possibility of the consciousness that they would have had you know, someone not interfered and stopped the viability of that life
yeah.
any longer. And that if it's true in the case she outlines, is it true in the case of the child who's effectively has that has been taken away from them? Even if they never knew it, it's still wrong to do it in that sense.
I'm more arguing that until that initial consciousness begins, there's no person to be harmed. So it's a little bit weird to think about, right? But it's a bit like if I asked, you know, like I'm saying abortion is more like, you know, using contraception on the day, you know, you might normally conceive, is that harming a potential child? I would argue no, because there's no child, there's no person there to be harmed. And so, you know, I think that this difference between, like, taking away an inheritance from a child is that, you know, you're making that child's life worse than it otherwise would have been. But in the case of abortion, or for that matter, contraception, I'm saying that there's simply no child there, no person there to be harmed. I'm rejecting that idea that, you know, the fetus is by itself a person.
Obviously, I do want to start to wrap this up, and I'm aware that Lois just has a different understanding of what you're dealing with at that point. You are dealing, as far as Lois is concerned, with a person, sort of, you know, and yes, even if that person wasn't conscious. Last question, and this comes out of the fact that you did mention Peter Singer, interestingly, and his views on animal ethics. But the whole question of when a child gains sort of moral status, and whether that's allied to the you know, this idea of personhood, is of course tricky, because, as you said, you see it as happening to coincide with the point at which a child is born. Okay, and you've said already, well, there might be other people who put it further back, you know, at a point where neurology is developing in the womb. There are, of course, people, Singer included, who have said, well, what if actually it's the other direction? What if actually it's after birth that really consciousness is really established? You know, what if it's, you know, there's a period of up to 28 days, let's say, when a child isn't really a person. There are some who've gone even further, a year or more. And at that point, you're saying, well, it would be legitimate potentially to kill a child if they were, you know, certainly disabled or in pain or something, but even, you know, because they were not, they were, you know, an encumbrance on a person's life or something like that. So is that a problem? Is that a problem if people kind of go in the other direction and say, actually, I think the personhood thing is after birth, actually, that there could be a period when you don't think of a child that's outside the womb as a person?
I mean, I don't think it's like a problem to make those arguments, but I think that those aren't going to be very compelling to people, because, you know, I think like a 3-month-old obviously has desires of some sort, is pretty clearly conscious, and it doesn't have that kind of maybe more advanced psychological capability that, you know, a 1-year-old has, probably develops, you know, that like kind of self-awareness, but there is psychological function there. And so I also think there's a bit of a moral risk argument where, like, you know, I think we should probably push that personhood back to where we see the first startings of consciousness, even if we think that personhood really should arise a little bit later, simply because there's no real need to, you know, euthanize babies or whatever. And there's no benefit to be gained from taking that stance.
Lois?
Yeah, I think we're just on very shaky ground there with that argument when it comes to human rights law, because as soon as you start qualifying rights, you're saying that some people are less people than others. As we know, historically, that has really been something that has been very disadvantageous to people who are in oppressed groups. And if we're also saying that some people are worth more as persons because they're better able to contribute, they're better able to speak, they're better able to do whatever it is. And as soon as we go into that territory of gradients of persons, some people being more persons than others, that's when we start to see the disabled community having struggles with having their rights upheld. Or even, you know, there's cases of women not having their rights upheld because of being seen in a different state of class and then translating that to personhood. So I think as soon as we get into the territory of qualifying fundamental human rights, such as the right to life, especially in that last answer there, it becomes just very, very difficult to uphold human equality for everyone. And that's what we know from experience is desperately important in society.
Yeah, so I think that's kind of like the moral risk argument again, right? Like if we make distinctions based on like psychological capabilities, then there's a risk it'll get misused. And I think there are two problems with that. One is that I think a biological standard is just as vulnerable to misuse. You know, saying you have to have this type of DNA or something, you know, to be seen as a human, and if you don't have that, you're out of luck. That seems, you know, very vulnerable to misuse. And I also think there's moral risk to Lois's argument, even if you accept that, you know, it's personhood is simply attached to being of a type human organism. You know, we do live in a world where, like, you know, animal life is widely disregarded. There's immense animal suffering. And we have to consider whether we are, you know, possibly doing, like, terrible things to, like, the natural world simply because we have the standard for personhood that just simply relies on being of a biological type Homo sapiens.
Yes, well, speciesism, as Singer puts it. But let's start to wrap this up. So perhaps a final thought from you, Lois, final thought from you, KS, and we'll call a day on this one.
Sure. Well, I think that the best case scenario that we can put forward as a society is not to say that a woman's right to choice is so up and beyond anything else that a baby's life is not important. It's equally not the best to say either that a baby's life is paramount and a woman doesn't matter. I think what we can agree on is that there are significant human rights concerns for women and for children in a pregnancy and protected. So I think that the best scenario that we can face is to find solutions that protect both of those lives, because both lives matter in a pregnancy. And we've outlined and gone back and forth as much as possible on the moral, the personhood status of a human being. But I think that it's vitally important to make sure that every single life of every human, no matter how vulnerable, no matter how small, no matter their age or stage or ability to think or to contribute, is absolutely valued. And it's the only way that we can really function on a basis of equality. And that's why it's so important that both sides matter.
Yeah. Final thoughts from you, KS?
Yeah. So just going back to where we started, you know, I think that the overturning of Roe versus Wade was disastrous in a material sense for American women. And we're going to fight hard to make sure our rights are restored. And I think that we really can bring a lot of these insights from philosophy into feminism to inform it and to make it stronger. And that's one of the things I'm hoping to do here. I think thinking about more thoughtfully about personhood and about bodily autonomy leads people generally to the conclusion that most, if not all, abortions are not immoral. It also leads to other benefits as well, such as more respect for the natural world, more respect for the animals we live with. And we can see a future in which, you know, we accept abortion while also accepting that, you know, other non-human animals are very important and that we shouldn't make decisions based on kind of arbitrary standards of what DNA type people have.
We'll leave it there. Thank you both for both arguing your perspectives so cogently. And I will again just say, if you want more from either of my guests today, Lois works for ADF.UK. That's their website, defendingfeminism.com for KS. The links are with today's show. And we look forward to hearing your feedback as well, perhaps in the comments, by getting in touch with the show, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. But for now, Lois and KS, thank you for being with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Would love to hear your thoughts on today's issue. You can email me unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also leave your thoughts over on my Twitter @unbelievablejb. You can find the show page on Facebook. That's facebook.com/premierunbelievable. And we've got some of your feedback coming up in just a moment's time on recent editions of the show here. And what a week it's been in terms of UK politics as well, with the resignation of Boris Johnson as Prime Minister, and of course all those resignation of cabinet ministers and members of the government that sort of signaled that. very interesting week as well for this to have happened, because I was at, on Tuesday morning, the National Parliamentary Prayer Breakfast, the first time it's met in person in the last few years for all the usual reasons. But about 700 people were there in the Grand Entrance Hall to Parliament to hear people talking, praying, music, prayers were sung. There has been speculation that some of what was shared from the stage may have maybe piqued the conscience of those who started to resign from that day forwards, putting that whole snowball into effect. So it was interesting to be part of that. I was there to help lead a seminar after the parliamentary prayer breakfast itself on finding the common ground, which is what we aim to do here on Unbelievable. So it was lovely to meet several Unbelievable listeners who were there at the National Parliamentary Prayer Breakfast, along with all the politicians and church leaders who turned out for it as well. Thanks to those who've been getting in touch this last week or so. This lovely email received from Kyle, fairly long time listener of the show, about 10 years, I think Kyle's been listening, but says, "Justin, it's been nearly 5 years since I last wrote to you, so I don't expect you'd remember me, but my name is Kyle, and you were kind to me in our previous exchange and sent me a couple of books, which I read and benefited from immensely, so thank you. I've been an atheist, then an agnostic, and now, in an exceptionally difficult time in my life, I believe I need Jesus. So I don't know if I should call myself a Christian yet, but if I'm not, I'm very close, at least. I've always valued your perspective, so was wondering if there was a particular study Bible you'd recommend for someone new to the faith, who's open to the faith and Christian perspectives, but will still have many questions while reading through the Bible. Thanks so much for your time. Hope you and your family are well." Well, it's an incredible privilege to receive a message like that, Kyle. And we've been in touch since, and I've suggested a few resources and things, and we've talked a bit more about how things are going along for you. But lovely to hear from you, and thank you for getting in touch. Always great to hear about, you know, the way that people's journeys progress over 10, 5 years. That's the beautiful thing about having done this show for well over 15 years now. Thank you so much for being in touch. This is from Justine, nearly my namesake, but I think this is from a female version of the name. Justine says, "I've got a 1-year-old, a 2-year-old, and a 3-month-old puppy. If I'm lucky enough for nap times to be in sync, I thoroughly enjoy listening to episodes of Unbelievable while cleaning. The thought-provoking discussions on all sorts of topics just may be what is keeping me sane. I remember listening a while back to an episode debating pro-life and pro-choice ideas, and since the overturning of Roe versus Wade, I've been hearing and reading many people saying that Christians who voted to overturn Roe are pro-life until birth and then pro-choice, and while Christians may tend to be personally more generous than others and adopt more, etc., they're against most life-giving political policies, universal healthcare, longer maternity leave, free childcare, etc. I'd love to hear a debate on why this is the case. Thanks for all your work in the ministry. The show has caused me to rethink some previously held truths and encourage my faith." Thank you, Justine. Obviously, we've done a sort of an edition of the show just today on Roe versus Wade, but not really tackling those sorts of issues, that whole question of whether evangelicals in the US are as pro-life after birth as they are before birth, in terms of the policies they support and so on. But thank you for the suggestion. It is taken. Thanks also to Ewan, Reverend Ewan Huffman, who gets in touch to say, "I so enjoyed your show tonight. I stumbled across it on the radio as I couldn't bear listening to Baker Street on any more radio stations. Excellent song, though, it is. I found it interesting, stimulating, authentic, mind-stretching and non-confrontational. So well done. I will be listening again. I'm a Baptist minister, seconded to the Church of England and employed as a chaplain. It's so good to have your Christian input, as I'm right on the mission field and the only Christian that some people know. Keep up the good work. I will listen and write again, no doubt." So glad you stumbled across the show via Premier Christian Radio, Ewan. And you can, of course, listen at your own time and convenience via the podcast, which is obviously the way many, many people do listen. Let's go from some of those general lovely emails coming in to these specific emails responding to last week's show. That was Rationality and Religious Experience, our big conversation, episode 4, between Guillaume Bignon and Graham Oppie. Guillaume Bignon shared his conversion story. Now he's a Christian philosopher and theologian. Graham Oppie, a well-known atheist philosopher, was opposite him. From the tweets, Keith Plummer said, "If you want a verbal MMA smackdown, well, this exchange between Guillaume and Graham Oppie isn't it. If you want a respectful, intelligent discussion, though, between two who strongly disagree, check it out. More of this. Thanks, Justin." James Anderson says, "Very interesting and enjoyable conversation between Guillaume and Graham on rationality, religious experience, and the case for God. A refreshing change from the usual Christian atheist slugfests. And Rosemary said, I've just listened to the discussion on rationality and religious experience and the case for God. Really good conversation, full of interest and ideas. Thanks to all the guests. Thank you. And Ken Miles gets in touch by email to say the big conversation between Oppie and Guillaume Bignon, which discussed the important topic of the evidential value of religious experience, was most interesting. As philosopher Philip Wiebe has highlighted, excluding such experiences from any consideration could mean that potentially unique insights about the cosmos and human life are overlooked. But it is a shame that there was no attempt to define objective criteria for evaluating religious experience. Based on the work of philosopher Nancy Murphy, there are three criteria which can be used. A. Is the experience widespread? B. Is the experience part of a network of interconnected experiences and theories? And C. Does the experience bring about changes in behaviour for the individual and their community, especially actions that carry a significant personal cost? The evidential value of an experience will be greatest when all three criteria are met. These criteria might have helped to distinguish Christian experiences from, say, boiling a donkey's head to predict the future, and as an aside, also from religious parodies such as Russell's Celestial Teapot. Thank you again for all your work on Unbelievable. Thank you, Ken, and thanks to all those as well who have been giving their feedback to the show via the survey mechanism. Now, it was out of action for just a few days, so if you clicked on it and weren't able to access it, you should be able to access it again. We'd really love your feedback that way as well, to get a big picture sense of how people respond to these big conversation shows. That's all we've time for on this week's episode of the show. We'll have more of your feedback next time. So thanks for being with us here on Unbelievable. Don't forget to get yourself booked in for our live conversation with Michaela Peterson and John McRae, happening this Tuesday, the 12th of July. Absolutely free to attend, and you can do that from anywhere in the world. It's an online live webinar. You can be part of it. Just register at unbelievable.live and be part of the conversation. For now, thanks for being with me. Let me tell you what's coming up next week. It's all about the big conversations at the moment, because episode 5 is on its way soon. Robotics, transhumanism, and life beyond Earth. Astronomer Royal Lord Martin Rees joins me, along with bioethicist Dr. John Wyatt, to discuss AI and robotics. Are they a friend or foe of human flourishing? Lord Rees recently published On the Future, a book about these themes, and John Wyatt has edited The Robot Will See You Now. Really interesting discussion coming up between them, including some clips of my conversations with other robotics experts, and even a short chat with a robot. So look out for that on next week's show. Until then, have a good week.